But right now, I'm extremely happy to have with us here this evening Paul Kavika Martin. He's political director with the group Peace Action, and we've invited Paul here to talk about a very important milestone in years-long negotiations with the nation of Iran over its nuclear program. As I know probably every one of you knows, that a framework was announced last week about a nuclear agreement negotiated by the P5 plus one nations, the permanent members of the UN Security Council, along with Germany. It's hopeful that this framework can turn into some kind of binding agreement. But there's a lot of obstacles in the road between now and then. And Paul, I'm so happy you could be here to sort of take us through these complex sets of issues in terms of the framework of the agreement itself, as well as those opponents that are going to do their best to derail it in the coming months. But before we start on talking about this issue, Paul, maybe just give our listeners a little bit of information about your organization, Peace Action.
Sure. I think many of your older listeners may know us as SANE. We started as SANE, the Committee for a SANE Nuclear Policy, back in the 50s. And we merged with something called the Freeze Movement, which was a movement in the 80s to freeze the number of nuclear weapons that were being built, and now we're called Peace Action. And besides working on abolishing nuclear weapons, we also work on getting the troops home from Afghanistan, different solutions in Iraq, Syria with ISIS, reducing the Pentagon budget, and other progressive foreign policy issues. And people can find out more about us at peace-action.org.
Thank you for that. So as we get started here, maybe it'd be important to summarize the key elements of this framework of the nuclear agreement that was negotiated and announced last week, and then we can sort of take on the bigger issues that are in front of us now as they work towards a June 30th deadline. But what are the key elements here that people should know about?
Sure, just a little brief history. Under the Bush administration, which used isolation and didn't have any talks with Iran at all, they built up their nuclear technologies, their centrifuge technologies, as well as the amount of low-enriched uranium. That is one pathway to the bomb, is using uranium, and you enrich it enough to 90%, and then you have enough to make a bomb. They were doing about 20% until the Bush administration about a year and a half ago, and the international community started talks with them. They rolled back their nuclear program a bit. At that point, they were probably somewhere in the range of 2 to 3 months, they probably could have had enough fissile materials to make a crude nuclear weapon. And I just want to repeat that. That is a crude nuclear weapon. That's not enough materials to, necessarily miniaturize a bomb so you can fit it on a missile, or having a proper missile that could actually deliver it. Definitely they would be years away from having any kind of delivery system or miniaturized bomb that could reach the U.S., for example. So in any case, we have been negotiating over a year and a half, and we have reached a framework of an agreement. That means they have pretty much come to general solutions for all the issues. They have figured out exactly what issues for sure will be on a signed piece of paper, and what's left to do is to get all the technical details. It's going to be probably a several hundred page document of technical details and agreements and timelines, and then sign, seal, and deliver it, and they have a deadline now of June 30th. This framework does pretty much two important things. Three important things. First is it will take the timeline for Iran to get the fissile materials to make a bomb for a crude nuclear weapon from 2 to 3 months to at least a year. So the breakout time for Iran, if it decided to make a nuclear weapon, and at this point we have no knowledge that it has ever wanted to do that over at least the last 5 or 6 years. So if it made a decision that it wanted to make a nuclear weapon, during this agreement, it would take them at least a year to get enough fissile material for a crude nuclear weapon. And that's done by blocking all the pathways to where they can get it. One, I mentioned using centrifuges. Their centrifuges would be reduced by two-thirds, the number of centrifuges, and they would only be able to use their most basic centrifuges, which is technology kind of back in the 80s. There are much newer, much more advanced centrifuges that can more quickly enrich uranium. They won't be able to have those centrifuges at all. The second thing is they already have, as I mentioned, low-enriched uranium in which they could, that's enriched up to about 20%, and over time they could make that into the 90% needed to make a nuclear weapon. That stockpile is going to be reduced some 95% for 15 years. And the third way they could make a nuclear weapon is using plutonium. They've been building a nuclear reactor in the city of Arak, A-R-A-K, and that reactor they have agreed that would be completely redesigned so that it wouldn't produce any weapons-grade plutonium, and all the current fuel rods and whatever would be actually dismantled and shipped out of the country. That would be a permanent solution to that reactor. It would never be a threat again. And then the last key point in the agreement is unprecedented inspections and monitoring. So the IAEA will have regular access to all their nuclear facilities, basically from soup to nuts, as they say, from the uranium mines all the way to shipping of uranium to storage of uranium. Any kind of nuclear technology will be open to inspections and monitoring, and they will be required to grant access to any kind of suspicious sites or any kind of allegations of covert facilities. So that takes away the covert avenue of making a nuclear weapon. So in summary, this definitely makes Americans safer. It makes the world safer, and we're hoping that people will continue to support the deal so they can finalize one and get one signed by June 30th.
Paul, does the fact that this announcement for the framework was made last week indicate to you that most of the more difficult issues have been overcome, and that the detailed agreement, which will be signed, by June 30th, hopefully, that will happen without a lot more disagreement? Or are there major issues that have to be overcome between now and June 30th?
So my reading of the way that both parties, and for the most part I'm talking about the U.S. and Iran, how they played it back to their constituencies, is that they've actually come to agreement probably around 95% of the things that need to be agreed upon. And there's probably about 5%. And I'm not going to minimize that 5%. One of the things that it's clear that probably was not worked out in the negotiations is exactly when, how the sanctions will be lifted from Iran. So Iran's going to do all those things that I mentioned, not just because they feel like good people, but because they've been suffering economic sanctions for a number of years, and they want to get those sanctions lifted. So you could look at the language that's written out that the U.S. sent around in a fact sheet, and you can interpret it a number of ways. Iran's interpretation, as they're saying it back to their constituency at home, is that as soon as the deal is signed, all sanctions will be lifted, and then that's how it's going to go. Whereas the U.S. has said that sanctions will only be lifted after certain steps are verified by the IAEA. So once they, cut their centrifuges by two-thirds and maybe a certain number of sanctions, and once they get rid of 95% of their low-enriched uranium, then a certain more sanctions. So more of a phased approach. So my guess is they could not reach the exact timeline and the exact agreement on what was going on there, so they used very ambiguous language on purpose. And we're trying to sell our hardliners here, and Iran is trying to sell their hardliners over there, and they still have that to work out. There's probably several other things that are kind of like that that need to be worked out over the next 2 or 3 months. But we do have 2 or 3 months, and we're a very long step ahead to reaching a deal. Let's not forget, it's only been a couple of years that we've had any kind of bilateral discussions with this country, so we've come a long way in the last two or three years, and we're probably at the, you know, for you football fans, we're definitely golden inches at this point.
Okay. We're speaking with Paul Kavika-Martin, political director with the group Peace Action, and we're talking about the framework that was announced for a hopefully a future agreement between the U.S. and the P5 plus one nations and Iran over its nuclear program. Paul, as we know, Israel, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is very much opposed to this agreement. Even before he saw the details, he was given a platform to oppose it before the Israeli elections. Looked very political, and of course, the whole issue of this nuclear agreement with Iran has morphed into an extremely partisan issue in the United States, Democrats versus Republicans. In your view, what is the biggest threat of opponents to undermine this deal in the coming months? You have Tennessee Republican Bob Corker in the Senate, who's got a bill that would require Senate ratification of any lifting of sanctions that would be part of this deal. But maybe you can give us your take on, who are the players in Washington that you think could undermine or derail this agreement completely?
Yeah, I think in the end of the day, it would be Congress, and especially this Corker bill, which on the surface says that it's meant to be an up or down vote whether or not to support or oppose the bill, but also has other language as it stands. Some language in there says that no sanctions could be lifted for 60 to 90 days, something like that. That certainly ties the hands of negotiators if they are already thinking about lifting, some minimal amount of sanctions in the beginning of the agreement. The second thing, which is I think probably the biggest deal killer, is there are some requirements for the Obama administration to certify that Iran is not funding terrorists. It's a very difficult thing to prove a negative. We know there are issues with Iran supporting Hezbollah and other things like that. That's a separate thing that we're going to need to deal with in Iran later on. That is not, should not be part of this historic deal that will make us safer in the end. So that's like the largest concern right now is Congress. People have control to put pressure on Congress. So Connecticut, for example, Senator Murphy has been very good, very measured, very responsible statements and work that he's been doing around this issue. On the other hand, Senator Blumenthal has not been very good on this. He has co-sponsored both the very bad bills that I think, one which would have put sanctions on Iran even before a deal was finalized, which thankfully the drafters of that legislation said that they will not have votes on that language until after a finalized deal. And the second one is he has co-sponsored this Corker legislation. So I think people could call and talk to, both their senators as well as their members in the House, because they will have to pass both chambers, obviously. Any kind of bill that would seem to be a deal killer will be vetoed by the president, and then we'll be down to some vote counting on whether or not the override the veto. So I would recommend people, give a jingle to their congressional delegation. For those who want that number, it's 202-224-3121, 202-224-3121, and I think Congress is kind of the big actor. Now, who's going to be pressuring Congress? Well, you do have Israel and groups that specifically support Netanyahu's stance here in the U.S. You have some of the old neocons from the Bush administration, people like Bill Kristof. You've heard from former U.N. Representative Bolton, both who say we should use military intervention into Iran to solve the problem, which most military experts say that's ridiculous. Not only would it cause probably a major conflagration in the Middle East. It would only set them back probably 2 years and force them to move down the path of trying to get a nuclear weapon, where, as it stands, they're not doing so. So I think those are probably the major forces that are that need to be overcome over the next few months.
Thanks for that. I wanted to ask you about the points made by opponents of this deal. Many opponents, majority of Republicans and some Democrats in Congress, oppose this deal, they say, because Iran cannot be trusted. They point to a track record of deception and other actions by the Islamic Republic of Iran that they say really makes any kind of negotiations or agreement with them suspect and inoperable. How do you respond to that idea that these folks are not someone you can deal with, that this government is not an entity that you can deal with?
I think you first look at who is supporting the deal to move forward as it stands. And you had mentioned Israel. There are some key people in Israel, like one of the former directors of Mossad, who supports it moving forward, one of the former directors of the intelligence community in Israel supporting. There's many in Israel who are supporting this, knowing that it's actually in Israel's best interest. I do think Netanyahu is doing more political posturing and sure trying to put as much pressure to squeeze as much of it as Iran as possible. But in the end, I think they're going to realize that this is a better way to go than military intervention. And on the trust issues, I think today there was something released by Republicans and Democrats, former military, former diplomats, 50 foreign policy military leaders signed a letter saying they support this deal, and another 30 specific high-level experts on non-proliferation and nuclear weapons issues signed a letter. That just goes to show, like, where these inspections and the transparency lies. Because as I don't often quote President Reagan, but he did say, trust but verify. And the key part of this agreement is the verification. You know, it's certainly, I wouldn't say it's perfect. You know, that if Iran says, we don't think you should come into a certain area, then there is some, as it stands, we're not clear exactly what the mechanisms to force that is, but they have mechanisms they've talked about. But this is unprecedented level of inspections and monitoring that we should be able to find out if Iran cheats. And then we're going to keep the sanctions framework alive. And any kind of a break, then sanctions will automatically snap back into place. And that's how we'll end up dealing with Iran.
Thank you, Paul. Paul, what are the consequences if Congress rejects this agreement and this accord that many people in the world are looking to avoid a future conflict, if this falls apart?
Yeah, sabotaging this deal would just further strains in relations with our most important NATO allies. You know, this is at a time when Western unity is being tested on a number of fronts. So, you know, we have the international community, we have major powers in the world. You had mentioned the P5 plus Germany, who are pushing towards this deal. They are not doing it, just for grins and giggles. They're doing it because they do think this is a way to solve one of the largest national security threats that the world faces, and that would be Iran acquiring a nuclear weapon. And if our Congress was end up sabotaging a deal that our president, our diplomatic corps, our Department of Energy, which included our experts at Lawrence Livermore Lab, all of our nuclear weapons experts were used to make sure that this deal would ensure that Iran would not get a nuclear weapon, any nuclear materials with at least a year. If that was scrapped by Congress, it would just be a horrible thing. You know, it's very difficult to see exactly what the ramifications are, but they are very, very bad. And so we hope that in the day, even if something was passed, that there's no way that they would have enough votes to override a veto. But that's still going to be pressure by not only people, but people writing letters to the editor and continued media like yourself. that are out there talking about this issue to educate the public to understand that this is in our best interest, that inspectors on the ground is better than boots on the ground.
What's frightening is that you have some neocons, including former UN UN representative or U.S. UN representative John Bolton, who served under George W. Bush, advocating war with Iran. What is public reaction here? I've read some polls that say there's fairly substantial support in the United States for this agreement, though opinions differ on whether this is really going to whether people think this is going to succeed or not. But how do the neocons and their advocacy of a military solution here line up against U.S. public opinion?
Well, they lose. I mean, if you're looking at the politics, especially presidential politics, you know, if you look at some Republicans, in some ways they do support the deal, but not as much as Democrats or independents. But in general, we're looking at figures anywhere from 60 to upper 70% who support a deal, and the same type of numbers who are opposed to military intervention. And the numbers are actually even higher and stronger in the presidential swing states. So the politics are you should be supporting this deal if, one, you want to be president, or, two, you want to be with the plurality of the American public.
So you think this could be a big issue in the 2016 election, unless this agreement is signed, sealed, and delivered before November of 2016, right?
Well, you know, I think that people might look, you know, once if this is signed, sealed, and delivered, and there's obviously good actions upon and verified by the IAEA by November of 16, if this looks like this has been the great success and finally President Obama has earned his Nobel Peace Prize, then the statements that were made by presidential hopefuls will be looked at, and they will be looked at carefully.
You know, one issue here that sort of is an emotional tagline to all this, and that is the claim by Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that Iran represents an existential threat to Israel, that Iran acquiring a bomb, which he says this agreement guarantees pretty much, is going to jeopardize the Israeli state. The fact that's rarely talked about in the U.S. media is that Israel, while it doesn't acknowledge it, but Israel is known to have some 400 nuclear weapons of its own, which I think in any rational world would be a deterrent to any attack by Iran or any other nation. How do you make out? How do you suss through this sort of cry that Israel's very existence is in jeopardy here?
Yeah, the hyperbole is just is unbelievable. The only country in the Middle East that does have illegal nuclear weapons is Israel, and also one of the few countries that has not signed the non-proliferation treaty, which actually Iran is a signatory of. The other thing is you see a lot of quotes that specifically use, you know, wipe Israel off the map, or the destruction of Israel, or this existential threat. And if you really look back at these quotes and what Iranians are talking about, I had the great luck to go to Iran for a few weeks, but few people actually know that the second largest number of Jews in the Middle East is in Iran. They are free to practice their religion. They have synagogues there. They're under no threat or discrimination. What Iran is talking about is that when they're talking about changing the lines of the map, they do not support necessarily the way Israel and Gaza are currently split. They support a two-state solution, which actually my organization also supports with Palestine. So they're talking about the solution between the Israel and Palestine conflict. They're not talking about destroying Israel or wiping it off the map, in which most people think that means, you know, killing all of Israel or bombing all of Israel. That is not the discussion that's being had. They certainly support Palestinians and they want to see a solution to the conflict there. But certainly Iran has done bad things, such as supporting Hezbollah and other groups of questionable tactics. But Iran is one of the few countries that can say over the last 200 years it has not attacked another country. I think that the best thing that Israel has right now is looking at this deal. And this agreement is definitely in Israel's interest. And that's why you see, some of these former Israel, intelligence people coming out for it. And you even see, Nicholas Burns, who was the negotiator on Iran's nuclear program under, Bush. Also supporting that this agreement move forward. It's in the best interest of Israel. It's in the best interest of the states, and obviously in the best interest of the world that this agreement moves forward and that Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us in assessing this framework agreement for us and the future obstacles ahead. Leave our listeners, if you would, with the web address for Peace Action so people can get more information.
Peace-action.org. Peace-action.org.
All right. Well, thanks so much, and we'll stay in touch because this is going to be a vital issue for all of us to keep track of in the coming months. But thanks for all your work there and for joining us tonight.
Appreciate it, Scott.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's Paul Kavika Martin, political director with the group Peace Action. We're talking about the framework agreement announced last week for a nuclear agreement with Iran.